You know, if I were to ask you to picture the most universally accepted bulletproof fact of science, you'd probably conjure up a memory from like eighth grade science
Oh,
class.
absolutely. We all have those.
Right, like you're building a solar system diorama out of painted styrofoam balls and wire hangers.
The classic styrofoam planets.
Exactly. And the golden rule of that diorama, the fundamental truth you are being taught to represent, is pretty simple. All planets move in ellipses.
Right. It's the quintessential scientific law.
Yeah, I mean, we've known it since Kepler looked up at the sky. Newton gave us the pristine math for it. It is a textbook rock solid science. But I was looking into some fascinating research recently, and it turns out that this statement, this universally accepted law, is, well, technically, it's a lie.
Or, at the very best, it is a highly, highly conditional illusion.
Wait, conditional illusion. Let's break that down because I think a lot of people just assume a law is a law.
Yeah, conditional is really the operative word here. That rule, it presents itself as a universal truth of the cosmos, right? A law that governs everything out there.
Right, like an unbreakable rule.
But when you look at the actual physics and the mechanics required to make an elliptical orbit happen, it only occurs under a remarkably delicate arrangement of factors.
So it's not just happening everywhere all the time
Not at
automatically.
all. The sun has to completely dominate the gravitational influence of the neighborhood. The planets have to be significantly less massive than that central star.
Okay, that makes sense.
And you can't have any rogue massive bodies like, say, a rogue Jupiter or a wandering black hole just passing through and perturbing the gravitational field.
Because that would just ruin the perfect ellipse.
Exactly. You also have to basically ignore solar wind, radiation pressure, and the fact that the planets themselves pull on each other.
Right, the universe is messy. Super messy. The moment any of those conditions change, or the moment you try to account for the reality of all those interacting forces, that so-called unbreakable law just shatters. The orbit ceases to be a perfect ellipse.
Wow. Okay, so I was reading this mind-bending paper by C.F. Dietz from a 2026 series, and it's titled The Grammar of Science.
Oh, yeah, brilliant paper.
It really is. Dietz is synthesizing the life's work of the renowned philosopher of science, Nancy Cartwright, and combining it with his own concept called the closure framework.
Right, he's bringing a lot of structural theory to her empirical work.
Yeah, and reading this completely broke my brain on the topic of scientific laws. Because the core question they are asking is massive.
It really challenges everything we think we know.
It does. They're basically asking, are scientific laws actual universal truths that govern everything everywhere, like some invisible grid? Or are they highly localized, incredibly fragile phenomena that only exist when we carefully set the stage for them?
What Dietz and Cartwright are doing is deconstructing the enduring myth of a seamless, perfectly governed universe. A myth. That's a strong word for something we learn in school as absolute fact.
I know, but the reality they propose instead is what Cartwright calls the dappled world.
The dappled world. I love that phrase.
Yeah, it's very evocative. It is a beautiful, messy, patched-together reality that actually makes a lot more sense of the world we live in compared to the pristine mathematical void we are taught to imagine in physics class.
Right, so today we're going to explore how we fundamentally misunderstood what a scientific fact actually is.
And it's an important journey to take.
Let's unpack this because this isn't just an abstract debate for astrophysicists.
Yeah, not at all. It impacts everyday life.
Exactly. I want to tell you, the listener, why this matters so much. Whether you are trying to understand the results of a new medical study about blood pressure medication, or parsing an economic forecast trying to predict inflation, or honestly just trying to figure out the physics of why traffic behaves a certain way on your daily commute.
Which is a nightmare, by the way.
That's a total nightmare. But understanding when and why so-called laws fail is going to make you an infinitely sharper consumer of information.
You really will never look at a headline claiming science proves X the same way again.
So, I want to start with Nancy Cartwright's most provocative claim from her early work. She essentially says that standard physics laws actually lie.
Yeah, and we need to define her parameters for the word lie very carefully here.
Right, she doesn't mean scientists are just making stuff up maliciously.
Exactly.
Yeah.
She isn't suggesting scientists are malicious or fabricating data, nor is she saying the mathematical calculations themselves are incorrect.
Okay, so what is she saying then?
She is specifically targeting the foundational laws of physics in their standard theoretical formulations.
Give me an example.
Consider the titans of classical physics, Newton's law of universal gravitation, Coulomb's law of electrostatic force, mm-hmm. Maxwell's equations for electromagnetism.
The heavy hitters.
The heaviest hitters. Cartwright points out that Newton's law of gravity describes the force between two point masses in a universe containing absolutely nothing else.
Wait, like just two objects in a total void.
A total infinite vacuum.
Mm.
And Maxwell's equations describe electromagnetic fields in the complete absence of any material media.
But, well, that describes a perfect empty void that doesn't actually exist anywhere in nature.
Right. They describe a fantasy.
A fantasy, wow.
Cartwright's point is that these laws do not describe the actual messy, complicated world we inhabit.
Okay, but they work, don't they?
They're completely accurate for the idealized situations they characterize, but they are systematically inaccurate for actual situations where multiple forces are acting at once.
Because in reality, matter has volume and texture and boundaries exist.
Precisely. When a leaf falls from a tree, Newton's law of gravity alone will not tell you where that leaf will land.
Right, because there's wind.
Wind, fluid dynamics, wind resistance, the shape of the leaf, a dozen other factors that the pristine law of gravity simply ignores.
You know, it makes me think of those perfect social media filters.
Oh, that's a good analogy.
Right, like the ones that smooth out your skin, provide perfect studio lighting, and blur out the messy background of your unmade bed.
I use those more than I care to admit.
We all do.
Well,
but the fundamental physics law is the filter. It shows this flawless, mathematically perfect version of reality. But nobody actually lives inside the filter.
Right. We live in the messy bedroom.
Exactly. We live in the messy bedroom.
And the traditional defense from physicists regarding that messy bedroom has always been, well, the fundamental laws are correct in principle. We just need to add practical corrections to account for the air resistance or the friction or the gravitational pull of a distant moon.
Basically, the law is perfect. The world is just annoying.
Yeah, that's the standard view. But Cartwright argues the exact opposite.
Really? How so?
She asserts that the very fact we constantly have to add these messy ad hoc corrections is definitive proof that the fundamental description, the pristine law itself, isn't about our reality at all.
Oh, wow.
It's about a hypothetical scenario.
But wait, let me push back on this. On behalf of anyone who has ever flown on a 747 or watched a rocket launch.
Sure.
If the law of gravity is a lie outside a vacuum, how did we calculate the Apollo moon landings? I mean, space isn't a perfect vacuum. There's solar wind, orbital debris, the uneven gravitational pull of Earth due to its ablateness.
All very real factors, yeah.
So if these laws don't describe reality, how do we use them to build reality? Are you saying NASA just built a giant temporary illusion in space?
Well, actually, the engineering behind Apollo perfectly illustrates Cartwright's point.
Wait, really? How?
Because the laws aren't false in their ideal domains. But they only hold ceteris paribus.
Ceteris paribus, that's Latin, right?
Yeah, it means all other things being equal.
Okay.
So when NASA sent a rocket to the moon, they didn't just plug Newton's law into a computer and hit launch. They had to constantly fire thrusters to correct for all the things the law doesn't account for.
Oh, I see. They had to actively force the rocket back onto the mathematical path.
Exactly. And when an aeronautical engineer builds a 747, they spend billions of dollars artificially creating an environment. The smooth fuselage, the specific atmospheric pressure in the cabin, the precisely shaped turbine blades where all other things are violently controlled.
They're essentially building a flying bubble where the law works.
They're forcing a tiny piece of the world to behave like the idealized mathematical model. The laws present themselves as universal, but they're strictly local.
Local to the 747 in that case.
Right. They only work when we actively shield the system from the chaos of the outside world, or when we artificially construct an environment that mimics the vacuum.
So if we accept that these laws don't just hang in the ether waiting for us to find them, we're left with a massive problem.
Yeah.
What is actually making that planet orbit the sun? If it's not a universal law pulling the strings from behind the curtain, what is the physical mechanism doing the work? What is creating the regularities we observe?
According to Cartwright, the answer isn't in the math.
It's not the math.
No. The math is just a description of an outcome. The answer is in the machinery. To produce a law, you need what she calls a nomological machine.
Nomological machine. I have to say, it sounds like a device from a Victorian steampunk novel, like a brass contraption with gears and steam whistle.
I know, it's a great term. Nomological simply relates to the laws of nature or logic.
Okay, so a machine for laws.
Exactly. A nomological machine is the physical setup that produces a law. Cartwright defines it with strict criteria.
What are the criteria?
It is a fixed arrangement of components with stable capacities operating in the right stable environment.
Fixed arrangement, stable capacities, right environment.
And the crucial takeaway is this. Without the machine, there is no law.
Let me make sure I'm wrapping my head around this.
Sure.
The law does not exist independently of the specific arrangement of matter that generates it.
You've got it. That is the core of her argument.
Okay, let's make sure we understand the mechanism here, because this is where the paper starts getting really dense. Cartwright uses this word capacities.
Yes, capacities are central to her whole philosophy.
She claims that to understand the machine, you have to understand capacities first. What exactly does she mean by that?
In Cartwright's view, capacities are the real fundamental building blocks of the physical universe.
Not the laws, the capacities.
Right. Let's return to the sun. The sun has the capacity to attract massive bodies. That is what it can do.
Just an inherent trait of the sun.
Yes. This capacity is a real latent feature of the sun. It exists regardless of whether the nomological machine is currently running and regardless of whether anything is actually orbiting it at that moment.
So the sun has that capacity even if it's completely alone in a dark universe with nothing to pull on. It still possesses the ability to pull.
Precisely. Now let's assemble the planetary machine.
Okay, let's build it.
You take the sun's latent capacity to attract. You arrange it with a set of planets. You shield it from outside perturbations, ensuring there are no other massive stars nearby.
Right. Keep the rogue black holes away.
Exactly. You ensure the sun remains the overwhelmingly dominant mass in the center.
So that's the setup.
Yes. And when you arrange all those capacities into this specific shielded machine, it produces a regular behavior. Elliptical orbits.
And that regular behavior is what we call the law.
Yes. The law, in this case, Kepler's law of planetary motion, is just the output of that specific machine running smoothly.
But if you tweak the machine, the law disappears, even though the fundamental capacities of the objects haven't changed.
Right. Take that exact same capacity of the sun gravity, but let's change the machine. Throw a massive comet into the mix, or tightly pack our solar system with three other dwarf stars.
It'll be chaos.
Total chaos.
Yeah.
That same gravitational capacity no longer produces perfect ellipses. It might produce hyperbolic trajectories, where planets are slung out into deep space.
Like in those sci-fi disaster movies.
Exactly. Or it might produce sheer, unpredictable chaos, like we see in the three-body problem.
But the sun still has the exact same gravity.
The capacity to attract is entirely stable. But the machine is what produces the regular, predictable law. No machine, no law.
Wait, let me make sure I understand the historical context here. Because you're basically saying traditional science thinks the pattern is the boss, but Cartwright says the ingredients are the boss.
That's a really fantastic way to put it, yeah.
I remember reading about David Hume and his ideas on cause and effect. How does this fit into what we've been taught about the scientific method?
Oh, this is a direct inversion of what philosophers call Humean empiricism.
So Cartwright is beefing with David Hume.
Big time. Following David Hume, empiricists believed that regularities, patterns of events happening one after another, were the fundamental facts of the universe.
Give me an example of Hume's view.
Hume famously used the example of billiard balls.
Yeah.
You see one ball hit another and the second one moves. You see this happen 1,000 times.
Right. Basic cause and effect.
Right. Hume argued that all we really know is the pattern. We observe the regularity. We call it a law of nature. And we assume that's just how the universe is fundamentally programmed.
And what about the actual forces inside the balls?
Capacities, in Hume's view, were just a shorthand, almost mystical way of talking about those regular patterns. He didn't think they were the fundamental reality.
But Cartwright is flipping that entirely.
She flips it completely on its head. The patterns, the regularities, the laws are not fundamental. The capacities are fundamental.
What a thing can do.
Yes. What a thing can do is far more important than the pattern it happens to be making right now. The billiard ball has a capacity to transfer momentum. That capacity is real, whether the ball is hitting another ball or just sitting in a velvet box in your closet.
Oh, that makes so much sense. It's like, okay, think about baking.
Baking. Okay, let's hear it.
You, as a human being, have the capacity to bake a cake. That is a fundamental fact about you. It's a latent skill, a capacity you possess.
Right, assuming you know how to bake.
Let's assume I do. Now, you only get a perfect, delicious cake. The regular, predictable outcome, the law of baking, if you will, if you're standing in a fully stocked kitchen with the right ingredients measured out and a working oven.
I like this analogy.
That kitchen is the nomological machine.
Let's expand on that kitchen, actually. Traditional physics, operating under Hume's assumptions, looks at you baking a cake in that kitchen and concludes, "Aha, we have observed a regular pattern. Therefore, there must be a universal law of cake making that applies everywhere."
Which is ridiculous.
It is. Cartwright looks at the same scenario and says, "No, the cake only exists because you painstakingly built a kitchen. You gathered the flour, you controlled the temperature of the oven, you kept the draft out of the room."
If you are suddenly dropped into the middle of a dense pine forest, you still have the capacity to bake. Your fundamental nature, your skills, haven't changed at all.
But you're not getting a cake.
Exactly. Because you are no longer inside the protective boundary of the kitchen machine, no cake is happening. You cannot manifest the regularity without the environment. So, if laws only exist inside these isolated machines, like a solar system or a sealed laboratory or a kitchen, what does that mean for the universe as a whole? We've established it's not a single, smoothly operating grid. So what does it actually look like?
This brings us to one of Cartwright's most famous and visually striking concepts, the dappled world.
Ah, there's that term again?
Yes. If you accept the premise that laws only hold when specific machines are running, then the universe cannot possibly be a unified, monolithic whole described by a single theory of everything.
So no grand, elegant equation that explains it all.
No. Instead, reality is a patchwork. It is a dappled landscape made up of local, isolated domains where specific machines are successfully running and producing local laws.
And what's between those domains?
Well, these pockets of order are separated by vast, wild spaces where those machines do not govern, and where different capacities interact in chaotic, non-lawful ways.
Like, instead of a pristine, infinite checkerboard where the rules are the same on every square, it's more like a quilt made of totally different fabric.
That's a perfect visual.
And some parts aren't even sewn together, right? They're just frayed edges, loose threads, and empty space.
That visual perfectly captures her argument against what she calls fundamentalism.
Fundamentalism, that's a loaded word.
In this context, fundamentalism is the default, deeply entrenched assumption of almost all modern physics. It is the belief that all regularities across all disciplines, from biology to chemistry to astrophysics, ultimately derive from a single fundamental theory.
The idea that it all boils down to one rule.
Exactly. It's the belief that these ultimate laws govern everything, everywhere, without a single exception. It is the holy grail of physics. It's Einstein's unified field theory. It's string theory.
Right, because physicists have spent decades and literally billions of dollars building massive machines like the Large Hadron Collider, explicitly trying to find this one unified equation that explains everything from a microscopic quark to a supermassive black hole.
Huge amounts of resources.
And Cartwright is sitting there looking at all this effort and saying, "You are chasing a ghost. The unity you are looking for doesn't exist."
She argues that fundamentalism is an unempirical leap of faith.
Wait, faith in science?
Yes. It is an aspiration. It's a philosophically motivated desire for a neat, mathematically elegant world.
Yeah.
But when you look at the empirical evidence, when you look at how astonishingly messy evolutionary biology is, how chaotic and unpredictable macroeconomics is, how incredibly fragile even basic fluid dynamics can be, the world simply does not present itself as a unified system.
So they're assuming it connects, but they don't have proof.
Exactly. The assumption that biology will eventually reduce to chemistry and chemistry will reduce to quantum physics is a faith-based claim. It has never actually been proven.
Well, doesn't this feel a bit defeatist?
How so?
Isn't giving up on a unified theory basically giving up on the ultimate goal of science? Like, if we accept the dappled world, aren't we just throwing our hands up and saying, well, the universe is just a localized mess, we'll never have a grand answer, so why bother trying to connect the dots?
It might feel defeatist if you view the universe purely through the lens of mathematics.
Okay, fair.
But if you view it through the lens of engineering and practical application, it's actually incredibly empowering.
Empowering?
Yes. It's about adopting a more accurate and, frankly, more respectful view of reality's complexity. The dappled world is rich. It is full of overlapping domains and wildly complex capacities. If we stop trying to force a single, universal blanket over a wildly irregular landscape, our science actually becomes more effective.
Because we stop trying to force square pegs into round holes.
Exactly. The true goal of science shouldn't be reducing everything in existence to one master equation. The goal should be mapping the patches on the quilt.
Understanding the boundaries.
Yes. Understanding the strict boundaries of our nomological machines. Knowing exactly where a law works and exactly where it hits a boundary and stops working. That is infinitely more useful for building medicines, economies, and societies than pretending a law is universal and being shocked when it spectacularly fails outside the sterile laboratory.
I mean, you wouldn't try to use the rules of chess to win a game of basketball just because they are both categorized as games.
Right. You need to know which patch of the quilt you were standing on.
I buy that. I really do. But as powerful as Cartwright's vision of the dappled world is, Dietz points out a massive gap in her work in this paper.
He does. And this is where the closure framework comes in.
Because she built this entire philosophy by looking at empirical evidence, by looking at how science actually operates in the messy real world, and observing that laws fail. But she didn't explain the underlying mechanics of why they have to fail.
Right. Cartwright proved inductively that machines are local. She looked at 1,000 different machines, mm-hmm. from pendulums to lasers to economic models, and said, look, every single one of these has boundaries. Therefore, the world is dappled.
Which is great, but...
But she didn't explain why they must be local from a perspective of first principles. She didn't prove that it is mathematically or structurally impossible for a machine to be universal. She just noted that we haven't found one yet.
And that is exactly where C.F. Dietz steps in, supplying the structural why behind the dappled world with his closure framework.
This is where the paper transitions from empirical observation to hard structural logic.
How does Dietz build this framework? Walk me through it.
Dietz wants to show us the absolute, unavoidable structural mechanics of why the universe must be dappled. To do this, he introduces the foundational concept of a closure regime.
A closure regime?
Yes. A closure regime is any organized system that stabilizes content.
Okay. Stabilizes content.
And it does this by performing three very specific actions.
Mm-hmm.
First, it draws distinctions. Second, it establishes identity criteria for its parts. And third, it maintains lawful relationships between those parts.
Let me make sure I'm visualizing this correctly. A closure regime essentially builds a fence.
A defense, I like that.
It decides what specific things are allowed inside that fence drawing distinctions, and then it sets the rigid rules for how those things are allowed to interact with each other inside the fence lawful relationships.
That is the perfect architectural metaphor. And by building that fence and setting those internal rules, the regime generates a local domain of order.
So inside the fence, it's organized.
But here's the most vital foundational concept in Dietz's entire framework. The very moment you draw a boundary to define what is inside a closure, you automatically, inevitably, and mathematically define what is outside it.
Because you can't have an inside without an outside?
Exactly. Dietz calls everything that falls outside the boundary the remainder.
Remainder. Like when you do division in grade school, you try to divide 10 by 3, the numbers don't perfectly slice up, and you have that stubborn little one left over that just won't fit the pattern.
It is structurally similar, but Dietz elevates the concept. In his framework, remainder is not just noise.
It's not just a glitch.
It's not a rounding error in a physics equation, and it's certainly not a temporary gap in our knowledge,
yeah.
waiting to be fixed by better future science.
So what is it?
Remainder is the absolute structural proof that a system, or a grammar, as Dietz sometimes calls it, is finite. You cannot have an organized system without generating remainder. The two are structurally codependent.
Okay, think about it like this. Imagine Nancy Cartwright is a brilliant globe-trotting botanist.
Okay, botanist Cartwright.
She travels the world, studies thousands of ecosystems, and writes this massive, empirically undeniable book proving that orchids only grow in very specific tropical climates. They only grow in specific patches of the jungle.
That's her dappled world.
Exactly. But then Dietz comes along as the molecular geneticist. He looks at the actual cellular DNA of the orchid and explains the exact structural biological mechanism that makes it physically impossible for the flower to survive in the Arctic snow.
Oh, that's a brilliant way to frame it.
Right. Like Cartwright showed us where the flowers grow, Dietz explains why the fundamental structure of the flower demands it.
Let's take your kitchen analogy from earlier and apply Dietz's remainder to it.
Oh, yeah, let's do it.
To make that perfect cake, to successfully run that closure regime, you had to control the environment. You had to lock the dog out of the kitchen so it wouldn't bump the oven. You had to ignore the phone ringing so you wouldn't mismeasure the flour.
True, baking requires focus.
The barking dog, the ringing phone, the humidity outside, all of those excluded, messy, chaotic things are the remainder.
Wow, okay.
You didn't eliminate the chaos of your entire house. You just built a temporary structural fence against it to bake your cake. The remainder is everything the kitchen closure regime actively excludes in order to function.
So Dietz is basically looking at the DNA of organization itself. If you want to organize anything, a solar system, a government bureaucracy, a mathematical theory, you have to define it.
And to define it, you must exclude things.
If I define a system as only things that are red, I have instantly, at that exact second, created a massive remainder consisting of everything blue, green, and yellow in the universe.
Right.
The very act of organizing necessitates the creation of an unorganizable outside. Therefore, a nomological machine must be local. It is structurally impossible for it to be universal.
Because a universal machine would have to include absolutely everything. But if a system includes everything, it can't draw any distinctions.
Which means it has no fence.
Without distinctions, there are no identity criteria. Without identity criteria, there are no lawful relationships.
Which means it wouldn't actually be organized at all. A system without boundaries is just the void. It's pure static. The moment you have structure, you have remainder.
It is a stunning piece of philosophical elegance.
Truly.
Now, let's look at exactly how Dietz meticulously maps his structural framework onto Cartwright's empirical findings.
Yeah, I've got the paper right here, actually. Let's walk through these five distinct mappings, because this is where the theory truly solidifies.
Let's do it.
All right. First mapping. Cartwright's nomological machine is exactly what Dietz calls a closure regime.
We've covered the basics of this, but let's dive into the implications. The fixed arrangement of physical components that Cartwright requires for a machine is exactly what Dietz calls the constitutive structure of a closure regime.
Give me another real-world example of this structure.
A laser, for example, is a closure regime. It has mirrors, an energy source, a gain medium. The physical arrangement of those specific parts is the regime.
Okay, moving to the next mapping. What Cartwright calls a scientific law, Dietz renames as a grammar relative fact.
This redefines our entire vocabulary around science. A scientific law is not a universal truth etched into the fabric of the cosmos.
It's just a local rule.
Exactly. It is a fact that holds true only within the specific grammar or scope of the closure regime that produced it. The law absolutely fails at the boundary of the closure.
What's a good example of a grammar-relative fact outside of physics?
Let's look at economics. The law of supply and demand is a grammar-relative fact.
Oh, interesting.
It only works inside a closure regime that assumes rational actors, perfect information, and a lack of monopolies.
Which is almost never the case in the real world.
Right. When those boundaries are crossed, when humans act irrationally due to panic, or a cartel controls the resource, the law ceases to be a fact.
It's only a fact relative to the grammar of the specific market it describes. That makes total sense. Okay, third mapping. The ceteris paribus condition. The all other things being equal caveat that physicists use to wave away friction and wind resistance. Dietz maps this to boundary conditions.
Cartwright noted empirically that laws only work when the environment is right. Dietz formalizes this structurally. A closure regime requires specific boundary conditions to maintain its internal identity and keep the remainder out.
Can you think of a time when scientists failed to maintain those boundary conditions?
Oh, a famous one. Think about Lord Kelvin in the 19th century trying to calculate the age of the Earth.
Okay.
He used the laws of thermodynamics, calculating how long it would take a molten sphere to cool down to Earth's current temperature. He confidently declared the Earth was roughly 20 to 40 million years old.
But the Earth is over 4 billion years old. How is a brilliant physicist so massively wrong?
Because of a boundary condition failure. Kelvin's closure regime didn't account for radioactivity. Radioactive decay inside the Earth generates massive amounts of new heat, constantly resetting the cooling clock. Radioactivity was the remainder of Kelvin's thermodynamic machine.
So because he didn't properly define his boundary conditions to account for that remainder, his grammar relative fact, the 20 million year age, was spectacularly wrong when applied to the real world.
Exactly. It shows how dangerous it is to mistake a local fact for a universal one.
That perfectly illustrates it. Okay, fourth mapping, capacities, the latent powers of things like the sun's gravity or the billiard ball's momentum. Dietz calls these closure contributions.
This one is subtle but profound. A capacity is an open-ended ability that a physical component brings to the structure.
Okay, so bringing something to the table.
Right. The sun brings its gravitational capacity to the solar system closure regime. That capacity contributes to the overall structure and helps maintain the lawful relationships inside the boundary.
So it's contributing to the closure.
But here's the key. The component is real, and its capacity is real. But how that capacity manifests depends entirely on the closure regime it is currently contributing to. The same capacity can do wildly different things depending on what machine it is plugged into.
Okay, and finally, the big one, the fifth mapping. the dappled world, Cartwright's patchwork universe. Dietz maps this to the world of irreducible remainder.
This is the grand conclusion of the synthesis. The dappled world is simply the reality of existence when you realize that the universe is filled with finite closure regimes.
And because every single closure must structurally generate remainder.
The world is permanently composed of organized patches surrounded by a permanent, unorganizable background of reality. The remainder is irreducible.
Meaning you can never get rid of it.
You can never eliminate it, no matter how good your science gets, because the very act of organizing creates it.
You know, I have a fundamental question about these machines, though.
Sure, go ahead.
We've talked about the solar system, which is a naturally occurring thing, and we've talked about lasers in kitchens, which humans build.
Yes.
Structurally speaking, does the universe care about the difference? Are naturally occurring machines subject to different rules than engineered ones?
Dietz and Cartwright agree completely on this. Structurally, they are identical.
Oh, really? No difference.
The planetary system is a naturally occurring closure regime. It maintains its own boundaries through the interplay of gravity and momentum in a mostly empty void.
Right.
A laboratory experiment, like a particle accelerator, is an engineered closure regime. Human scientists use thick lead shielding, supercooled magnets, and extreme vacuums to maintain the boundaries.
So we build the fence instead of nature building it.
But in terms of the structure, in terms of generating laws and generating remainder, there's absolutely no difference. The fundamental physics doesn't care who built the fence. It only cares that a fence exists and that a boundary has been drawn.
So if every machine, whether it formed from a nebula or was built in a lab, has a fence, and every single fence structurally necessitates a remainder, this is the final, absolute death blow to fundamentalism.
It is the mathematical nail in the coffin. Dietz points out that for fundamentalism to be true, for there to be a single, unified string theory or a universal equation of everything, there would have to exist an infinite closure.
An infinite closure.
A machine that covers the entirety of the universe, generates absolutely zero remainder, and excludes nothing.
But by Dietz's definition, a closure regime has to draw a distinction. It has to have an inside and an outside. An infinite closure is an oxymoron. It's like trying to draw a triangle with two sides.
It is a structural impossibility. Therefore, fundamentalism isn't just empirically lacking because we haven't built a big enough particle collider yet. It is a structural impossibility.
The universe cannot be governed by a single theory because organization inherently mathematically requires boundaries. I know this sounds like we are deep in the abstract weeds of philosophy of science here, but Dietz's framework isn't just for quantum physicists trying to reconcile gravity and quantum mechanics. It directly impacts things we deal with every single day. Let's transition into how this applies to the real world, specifically human health and medicine.
Yes, let's look at that.
Because Dietz refers to this as the grammar of healing.
Dietz brilliantly uses modern medicine as the proving ground for this theory. Let's analyze the absolute gold standard of medical science, the randomized controlled trial, or RCT.
Oh, we hear about RCTs all the time. Whenever a pharmaceutical company announces a new drug on the news, they tout the double-blind randomized controlled trial.
It's the ultimate gatekeeper in medicine.
It's how we scientifically know if a drug actually works or if it's snake oil.
Right. But let's view the RCT through the lens of the closure framework. The RCT is not a passive, neutral window into universal human biology.
What is it then?
The RCT is an incredibly complex, highly engineered, incredibly expensive nomological machine.
It's a closure regime.
It is a strict closure regime. Scientists build it deliberately to isolate specific chemical capacities and produce a grammar relative fact.
And in this case, the fact is whether the chemical compound causes a specific, measurable biological outcome.
Exactly.
Think about the immense effort that goes into building the fence for an RCT. They have strict inclusion and exclusion criteria. They control for patient age, for pre-existing conditions, for dietary habits.
All boundary conditions.
They use a control group. They blind the doctors so the doctors don't know who's getting the real pill. They blind the patients. They are building a massive fortified boundary.
They are trying to create a biological vacuum. But remember, Dietz's unbreakable rule. Every finite closure generates remainder.
Right, whatever falls outside the fence.
Whatever is excluded by the definition of the system becomes the remainder.
Yeah.
And the RCT draws its boundary very specifically. It isolates biological chemistry, and it intentionally, deliberately tries to exclude human cognition, expectation, and psychological belief.
Because they want to know if the chemical works on the tissue, regardless of what the patient thinks.
So if the machine is designed to isolate chemistry and exclude belief, what is the remainder of the RCT machine?
Oh, wow. It's the placebo effect.
It is the placebo effect. Because the RCT machine explicitly draws its boundary exactly between the biological and the cognitive, the causal mechanism of placebos, where a patient's belief and expectation actually trigger neurochemical changes that alter biological outcomes, inherently falls completely outside the regime's organizational scope.
The machine is explicitly designed not to measure it.
The machine treats it as noise.
This completely reframes how we interpret medical data.
It really does.
When a peer-reviewed medical study concludes, this drug successfully lowers blood pressure, that isn't a universal truth about all human bodies across all contexts. It is a grammar-relative fact produced by the specific machinery of the RCT. And when a patient in the control group takes a literal sugar pill, believes it's the real medication, and their blood pressure drops anyway, that placebo effect isn't a failure of the drug.
No, it's not.
It isn't just noise in the data to be discarded. The placebo effect is the irreducible remainder of the trial structure manifesting in the real world.
And this is exactly why the medical establishment has struggled for a century to understand the placebo effect.
Because they've been looking at it wrong.
They have been trying to treat a closure relative fact, the chemical efficacy of the drug, as a universal biological law. They view the placebo as an annoyance, a statistical hurdle to clear, rather than recognizing it as the structural remainder of their own testing apparatus.
The exact same analytical path that explains why Newton's law of gravity fails when a leaf falls in the wind is the exact same path that explains why modern drug testing cannot comprehend the placebo effect.
It's astounding.
Cartwright and Dietz are describing the exact same structural truth across entirely different disciplines. Whether we are looking at planetary orbits, fluid dynamics, or clinical trials, the rule holds. Finite systems generate local facts, and those systems generate permanent, irreducible remainder.
It is a profound synthesis. It demands that we look at the entire landscape of human knowledge differently.
As we zoom out and look at the whole picture, it really does ask you to be more critical, but in a highly constructive way.
Yeah, it's not about rejecting science. It's about understanding its shape.
To summarize our journey today, we do not live in a universe of unbroken universal laws sitting on a pristine mathematical grid.
We don't.
We live in a dabbled world, a patchwork quilt of nomological machines and closure regimes. Some of these machines are naturally occurring, like the intricate balance of the solar system. Some are engineered, like the medical RCT, the Large Hadron Collider, or the aerodynamic shape of a jet engine.
And each of these machines produces local, conditional facts.
And every single one of them, without exception, is surrounded by an ocean of unorderable, chaotic, irreducible remainder.
This framework provides a highly practical lens for evaluating the information we are bombarded with daily.
And that leads to our call to action for you, listening right now. Sometime this week, you are going to see a news headline claiming a new scientific breakthrough. Or you'll read an economic policy forecast guaranteeing a certain outcome. Or you'll hear about a new dietary study claiming a certain food universally causes health problems.
It happens every day.
When you encounter these claims, I want you to ask yourself two very specific questions. First, what is the specific machine, the closure regime, they built to produce this fact? What were their boundaries?
And second, what is the remainder they are actively ignoring in order to make their local law look universal?
Once you start looking for the machine and the remainder, you will see them everywhere.
It is a tremendously empowering way to engage with the modern information landscape. It prevents you from being intimidated by grand universal claims because you know structurally that everything has a boundary. You know that every system excludes something.
Before we wrap up, I want to leave you with one final provocative thought to mull over. It's an extrapolation that wasn't deeply covered in the paper, but it builds directly on what we've learned today.
Okay, that's right.
Right now, humanity is engaged in a frantic multi-billion dollar race to build artificial general intelligence AGI.
The big AI race.
The ultimate dream of the tech sector is to build an AGI that can perfectly model, predict, and organize the entire world. They want to create a unified system to manage our economies, our supply chains, or healthcare.
A totalizing system.
But let's apply Dietz's framework to this ambition. An AI, by definition, is an organized system. It is a closure regime governed by code, algorithms, and strict data boundaries. Therefore, according to the inviolable laws of structure, it is mathematically and structurally impossible for an AI to model everything without generating remainder.
An infinite AI, an all-encompassing algorithm, is a structural impossibility.
Exactly. And here is the chilling consequence of that impossibility. Every finite closure must generate remainder. The larger the system, the more ambitious the boundary, the more massive and disruptive the remainder becomes.
Oh, wow.
If an AGI tries to systematically organize all of human society, the very act of that extreme organization will structurally force an unprecedented amount of unpredictable, chaotic remainder into existence at its boundaries.
So the attempt to perfectly organize society actually creates chaos.
The harder the AI tries to control and predict human behavior, the more chaos it will structurally create in its own blind spots. The ultimate question of the 21st century isn't just whether the AI will be smart enough to govern us.
No, it's about the remainder.
The question is, can human society survive the colossal remainder generated by our own ultimate machine?
That is a profoundly unsettling yet structurally sound application of the framework. It really highlights how these philosophical concepts have life or death implications for our future.
It really does. Thank you so much for joining us in exploring the messy, dappled, beautiful reality of the world. Keep questioning the universal laws, keep hunting for the machines, and above all, stay curious.